The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime released its 2023 World Drug Report on June 26th. UNODC and the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy held a webinar July 6th to discuss the findings. We'll hear portions of that in a moment, but first. On July 7th, the Government of Scotland issued a paper entitled A Caring, Compassionate, and Human Rights-Informed Drug Policy for Scotland. Now, I don't have any audio on this for you yet, nor do I have a guest lined up, but that's in the works. For now, let me read you this paragraph from the report. Quote, "This paper argues how the reform of the UK's drug laws offers an opportunity to contribute to a public health approach. It begins with a summary of how drug laws can affect drug harms before calling for immediate legislative changes to support harm reduction measures, arguing for decriminalization of possession for personal supply, and examining the opportunities for a future debate on strict regulated markets." End quote. Here's a little more. Quote, "We hold that the purpose of any drug law reform must be the reduction of harm. As a general principle, that harm can be exacerbated both by excessive prohibition, but also excessive legalization. A balance is needed between strict prohibition at one extreme, which perpetuates harm through criminalization, stigma, discrimination, and a thriving illicit market, and an unregulated legal market with no controls at the other, perpetuating harm through a profit-driven commercial market. Both produce poor public health outcomes. Any legal framework must therefore operate in between these two extremes, with public health as its primary driver, investing in research and evaluation and being guided by experts, including those with lived and living experience and taking account of public attitudes." End quote. Again, this paper is entitled A Caring, Compassionate, and Human Rights-Informed Drug Policy for Scotland. It was issued July 7th by the Government of Scotland. You can find it easily at the Scottish Government website. That URL is gov.scot. That's gov.scot. Let's turn now to the 2023 World Drug Report, which was issued recently by the UNODC. The International Society for the Study of Drug Policy and UNODC held a webinar entitled A Scientific Look at the 2023 World Drug Report on July 6th. We're going to hear a few of the speakers. Angela May, PhD, is chief of the Research and Trend Analysis Branch at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime.
So to start, you know, with the main finding that we have from the Amazon Basin analysis. So basically, you know, we have started last year to look at the impact of environment on the environment of the drug issue. And what we realized when we have done this last year is that really the issue is very complex. And more than a big direct impact on the environment, we have an indirect impact on the environment. And what we have also learned from last year is that the impact is not global. You know, it's not the drug, they're not the drugs that challenge or are the big problem in terms of environmental degradation or environmental challenges. But where actually the drugs become important in the impact is at the local level. So that's why we decided that for this year to focus on an area that is so important for environmental balance, for biodiversity, that is the Amazon Basin. And the Amazon Basin is also where the cocaine trade all starts. So it's also where, you know, it's very important also globally, not only from the environment, but also from the drug side. So what is the main finding when we have looked at this analysis? Is that, again, it's not much the drug cultivation or trafficking per se that impact the environmental ecosystem, but it's more of what particularly the cocaine and partially also the cannabis business brings to the communities at the local level. And that is what opens up to other type of crime, being the illicit logging, wildlife trafficking, illicit mining, that then cause really the largest environmental impact and the largest impact on the community. Environmental impact that is triggered by environmental crime that is triggered by then drug trafficking and drug cultivation. And here is just zooming into something in Bolivia, for example. Again, the small red dots that you see there is deforestation, and the gray area is where there is coca cultivation. And where you see the big black dots is where there are protected areas. So what this kind of analysis, just visualizing happens is that, again, it's not the drug cultivation or the coca cultivation that drives deforestation in Bolivia. But what the drug cultivation is now is happening is driving deforestation in protected areas. And now we know that also almost half of the cocaine in certain areas, cultivation happens in protected area, and not only in Bolivia, but also in the other countries. Here is another example in Brazil, again, to make the point where all of this converge and where this convergence affect also, certain communities. And here is an example of, for example, illegal airstrips. The illegal airstrips this is Brazil. And where, really all of this converge. And we have examples of seizure made, of shipment, both inside the Amazon and outside, that shows how this convergence happened, where the drugs get together with the illicit logging and with other, commodities that, affect the environment. And also the evidence that we have of this convergence is also when we see that drug trafficking organizations are involved in this other environmental crime. Again, here is an example that you see with deforestation and illicit mining and the illegal airstrip. Again, to show how all of this at a certain point converge, and then I will wanted to focus on the impact that there is not only from the environmental side, but also on the communities. And here is an example from Colombia. And again, the gray area is cultivation, but what you see that there are certain areas where there is a concentration of drug cultivation, deforestation, and violence. And the violence that affect civilians, but also here you see attacks to environmental defenders. So what basically here is an example of how all of this convergence of crime that is triggering away from the drug economy really affect the communities, and particularly the indigenous community. Kathleen, you started by acknowledging, the land of the community. Here, these areas affect the largest territory of an indigenous community, the Yanomami community. And you see here how the community in a way try to defend the territory. Here's an example of the impact on the environmental defender. So I don't have a lot of time to go through this because I'm conscious of the time. But so now I want to switch to the issue that we have seen from a regulatory point of view this year. And we looked at the regulatory developments relating to psychedelics and also the regulation for medical use of cannabis. The idea that drove in a way this analysis is to understand what are the issues that affect this balance that we have in the International Convention of providing access for medical use and while preventing the diversion and non-medical use of the substances. And so for psychedelics, you all know, I guess, in the audience, how this is evolving very rapidly. And so what we have analyzed is to say, first of all, what is the scientific evidence tell us? And clearly, there is evidence that is still on the making in some cases, the latest step for, medical research, but that really gives hope that indeed psychedelics could really treat conditions that today are hard to treat. But on the other side, also there is scientific evidence that says that if these substances are used non-medically, they also they can be harmful. So again, that's the issue of the balance. So what we have looked at is, okay, how is today how are today used psychedelics? And clearly, as I mentioned, medical use, and some countries have gone even through even if the medical research is not there completed yet, there has been there is clearly medical use, but there is also spiritual and traditional. Some of the use of this psychedelics really are rooted also in very, again, often indigenous also traditions. But there is also a larger, increasing unsupervised self-therapy that is driven by this perception that the research has created on, how these substances could be good for certain conditions. But there is also a larger, in some cases, large non-medical use of psychedelic substances that, produce harm. And this is just an example of a non-medical use of ketamine and LSD. So, To conclude, for the psychedelics, what we have really seen. So there are clearly current efforts that are in speeding up medical use and in some cases also legalizing the use of psychedelics. I mean, here is an example of a map in the US that's changed every day. So it's already not updated. But what is happening is that some countries, in a way, are speeding up the medical use. And in some cases, even when, in a way, the normal regulatory system for approval of medicine have not followed exactly the same as for other type of medications. So what are the challenges? The challenges is that, again, the medical research is still ongoing. So it's not that the medical research has answered all the questions on how and why and if the substances are used for treating conditions. And the other challenge is clearly a push from the medical sector in shaping this new policy and making it as soft as possible so that more people can use it.
That was Angela May, PhD, Chief of the Research and Trend Analysis Branch at UNODC, speaking on a webinar entitled A Scientific Look at the 2023 World Drug Report that was held July 6th by UNODC and the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Bo Kilmer, PhD, is Macaulay Chair in Drug Policy Innovation, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center, and a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation.
So I want to say just a few words about the chapter with respect to psychedelic research. And I just want to say, I thought this was a very useful primer for policymakers. This isn't a terribly long document, 14 pages or something, but there's a lot of really good information in here. So I not only think it's useful for those that are making decisions about these substances, but I also think for those of you who are teaching university courses, I think it could actually make for a nice reading for courses related to substance use and drug policy. It's, as I said, a nice primer. It also, it does have this thoughtful review about some of the prior ongoing clinical studies. And as Angela alluded to, things are changing quickly in this space with respect to research and policy. And I thought it provided a nice basis for kind of building on in terms of understanding where the research is going and where there still may be gaps. And the other thing I really liked about the chapter is it highlighted some of these emerging policy changes. And Angela alluded to a few of them in her presentation. So I spent a little bit of time talking about kind of that map of the United States that Angela showed. And just to make it clear, as in most countries, the supply of most psychedelics are prohibited by U.S. federal law. But of course, there are exceptions, right? You for research purposes, for the clinical trials, animal studies. There are also a few different mechanisms to allow for compassionate use. This is something that Chloe just discussed with respect to cannabis. So we do have an expanded access program, which, I think there are a few dozen people who are receiving access to MDMA, which is an investigational drug at this point. I'm not aware of anyone that's accessing this for psilocybin. And of course, there are also religious exemptions. But what's getting a lot of attention in the United States is kind of what's happening kind of at the state and local level. And this is something I actually want to applaud UNODC about, is that they actually make a distinction between decriminalization and legalization. Because oftentimes, especially in the media, they'll just refer to all of these reforms as decriminalization, and that ends up creating a lot of confusion. Where when we talk about decriminalization, we're usually referring to making the possession or use a non-criminal offense, but it's still illegal. And in most cases, decriminalization has nothing to do with supply. So when people kind of talk about all these reforms as being decriminalization, it makes it hard to kind of have productive conversations here. And so in the United States, there have been a lot of changes, and a lot of them have happened at the local or at the city level. And a lot of these I would describe as deprioritization, where in these cities, they haven't necessarily been since 2019. But I just want to make it clear here that in these places, the law hasn't changed. In fact, there is one place that has decriminalized possession of all controlled substances, and that's in Oregon with an initiative that was passed in 2020. Now, it's still illegal, but it's not going to be a criminal offense. Typically, if you get caught with small amounts, you'll get what's called a kind of a Class E violation, which is essentially you either pay a fine or you undergo an assessment, and then you can kind of waive the fine. But also that same year in Oregon, the voters passed another initiative to create licensed psilocybin supply and regulation for supervised consumption. And this is something they're in the process of rolling out. They've been working on the regulations for a while. And, you know, it requires that those that are cultivating, those that are providing facilitation services, those that are, you know, businesses that are going to be providing the supervised consumption, that they all get licensed by the state. And so that's starting to roll out in Oregon right now. In Colorado, in November of 2022, the voters there passed something somewhat similar with respect to allowing either sometimes they're called psilocybin or sometimes they're called healing centers. Right now, it's only focused on psilocybin, but within the initiative, it actually said within a couple of years, they may expand this to other nature-based psychedelics. But what doesn't get as much attention is in Colorado, with this initiative, they also legalized the possession, the use, cultivation, and sharing of five different nature-based psychedelics, whether it be psilocybin, psilocin, ibogaine, mescaline, and DMT. And there are no quantity limits as of right now. This could potentially change. But this is now, so this was kind of the first state to legalize it for all adults. But you can't go into stores. So it's at this moment, it's very different from what we're seeing in a lot of places with cannabis, but that could change. And I should say kind of in terms of what states might change next, California in the state Senate recently passed a bill to also allow possession and sharing of those same kind of five nature-based psychedelics. It passed in the Senate. It made its way to the House. It's passed one subcommittee on public safety there in the Assembly, kind of the other House. And now it's being considered by the Assembly's Health Committee. And it's unclear about whether or not it's going to pass. But I suspect that you're going to see other states kind of, you know, considering similar legislation, and there probably will be more ballot initiatives as well. And so just in terms of concluding thoughts, I want to be mindful of time. You know, in some ways, what we're seeing is kind of similar to what we saw with medical cannabis in the U.S. Years ago. But, you know, as Angela stressed, this is moving. The policy changes are moving much more quickly. And, you know, and with, even though this is, you know, it's prohibited at the federal level, these state and local policy changes, they raise important questions for the government, you know, with respect to, you know, treating veterans. What's our Department of Justice going to do? So as I said, what's happening in Oregon and Colorado right now is still illegal under federal law. And so the federal authorities could take action. You know, a lot's going to depend on kind of who's running the administration. So even if their approach right now is not to get involved, if there's a new presidential administration, that could change. And the final point I want to make is that this just, for all of us kind of policy researchers out there, this creates a lot of new opportunities with all these different changes at the state and local levels. And I just saw that NIDA just put out a call for psychedelic policy research, which I think the first one is due in October. So I think you're going to continue to see other organizations and other foundations kind of providing research support. And I think this information will be useful to kind of help update this chapter in future World Drug Reports.
That was Bo Kilmer, PhD, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center, speaking on a webinar entitled A Scientific Look at the 2023 World Drug Report that was held on July 6th by UNODC and the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Tim Bukat von Solinga, Ph.D., is an independent criminologist, a UN consultant, a research fellow at the Department of Criminology at the Erasmus School of Law, Erasmus University in Rotterdam, and founder-director of the Forest Forces Foundation.
I was actually last week in the Amazon when I was asked by a Dutch media to comment on the chapter. So I was reading the chapter in the Amazon, and I was baffled, I should say. I said, wow, finally. I was really happy that the UNODC is dedicating a special chapter on this, because the Amazon, as we can read almost every day in the news, is already under threat of environmental crime, deforestation for agriculture mainly, illegal mining, illegal logging, lots of environmental crimes that threaten the forest, the biodiversity, and human inhabitants. But now, and as I've been visiting the Amazon for 20 years now for research, and I've seen the gradual rise of environmental crime and drugs crime. And the three cocaine-producing countries, Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia, all, I sometimes say, all have their back door in the Amazon. And I've been in Colombia and in Bolivia for research. For example, I was doing research in Bolivia on the jaguar poaching and the trade in teeth, for example, and skins. And then one part of Colombia is just inaccessible for research, basically, because it's controlled by the narcos. Well, I've had similar experience in Colombia, near Cali, where certain parts are controlled by either left-wing FARC or right-wing paramilitaries who are even more violent. So the real challenges of South America. And then in Brazil, which has two-thirds of the Amazon within its borders, and Brazil has actually bigger criminal organizations than Colombia, if you in terms of numbers, huh, of men, mostly men, of course, and it's very worrisome. And so in the Amazon, you can see the rise of organized crime. So I'm really happy that there's now a chapter on this. So me personally, I'm an independent criminologist, and I've actually moved more and more to crime science. I've been publishing now almost for 20 years on illegal deforestation in the Amazon. And 10 years ago, I thought, I'm only writing about problems, and I'd like to work more on solutions. And I was doing a scientific project funded by the Netherlands of the Dutch Research Council on conflicts over deforestation. And most 90% of all deforestation in Brazilian Amazon, which is where most of the total Amazonian deforestation takes place, is illegal. 90% is illegal. 90% of the logging is illegal. 90% of the forest conversion for agriculture, cattle and soy, is illegal. Almost all of the, well, let's say 99% of the gold mining is illegal, serious crime threat. So I decided 10 years ago, we should focus on prevention instead of law enforcement. Of course, we need law enforcement. Prevention is the best strategy. And we should work more together with indigenous forest guardians. So now I've built up an alliance with indigenous forest guardians. And I'm also teaching to the public prosecutor's office in Brazil. So let's say I hear a lot, I travel a lot, and I hear a lot, and I see a lot. Maybe now, if we look at this map, so Brazil, again, two-thirds of the total Amazon, and Brazil is becoming a new trade hub, especially for cocaine to Europe. And the way I look at it is that Brazil is now a bit in the position of Mexico 20 years ago, when Mexico became the main trade hub or transit country for cocaine to North America, especially the US. Brazil has transformed already into the main trafficking hub for cocaine to Europe, because Europe is clearly now a bigger market than the US. Apparently, it looks like it if we look at it. And Brazil, 48% of South America, it's a very developed country with a lot of agriculture and also industrial export to Europe. So it's an 7,000 kilometers coast. So it's ideal for exporting to Europe directly and via Africa, as the maps show in the report. But also Brazil has almost 8,000 kilometers of border with the three cocaine producing countries, Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. And if you travel through the border areas, which or nearby, you can really see lots of investments. For example, one type of investment that I see is there's lots of pharmacies growing in small towns, a lot of pharmacies. You think, oh, why there's the pharmacies? Well, the Cali cartel already in Colombia had a whole pharmacy chain, but well, if you're in cocaine business and you own a pharmacy chain, it's easier for it to buy certain chemicals, certain equipment for laboratories. So you wonder, hey, why do we have so many huge pharmacies in certain small towns? Well, there might be a reason for it. And there's all types of other investments that you can see in the Amazon River that locals, because I know many locals, that you can say, okay, this is very doubtful what's going on here. An important, what's really important, I think that the report highlighted that criminal groups are diversifying and investing in all kinds of forest-related activities, especially logging, a seemingly legal product that can be that has gives direct access to Europe or to North America or to other countries. And, you know, if you in the middle of the Amazon, you can put cocaine in a container or a ship with logs, and it goes directly to the European market. So it's a very attractive product to both to launder money in logging companies and as a way to smuggle drugs. In general, also with drug criminals are investing in farms, ranges. And the other sectors we hear less about, which I want to highlight, which is for the carbon cowboys, as they're called. So companies, corporate criminals, basically, offering carbon credits, but there's a lot of pirates there on this market, the carbon cowboys. There have been a few articles in the Brazilian press about this. Also, there's money laundering in real estate, but also, again, in lots in agriculture and ranches. And I don't think there's much attention for this. Maybe to also have to mention a positive point. It was mentioned in the report, the illegal gold mining in the Yanomami. They were it's near the border with Venezuela. Here in northern Brazil, there were 30,000, beginning in January, there were still 30,000 illegal gold mines in the Yanomami area. 10,000, 30,000 inhabitants. There were 30,000. Now 25,000 have been removed, the report mentioned it. So there's 5,000 left. So they're resisting. So it's still 5,000 and armed. So it's a huge problem. But 25,000 have been removed or have left because the Brazilian army and have taken control of the airspace. So they cannot long be supplied by helicopters and planes. So this is positive. So, and then to close, I think this shows actually the importance of law enforcement and the importance of the presence of federal authorities. This is organized crime is part a function of the presence of state institutions. So over the last year, state institutions have drawn back. They were cut down environmental law enforcement, which gave a lot of opportunities for organized crime groups to move into the Amazon. So I just want to stress the importance of the presence of state institutions in these remote areas that are very vulnerable for organized crime. And the second point, as a conclusion, I would like to highlight the importance of international law enforcement cooperation, because most of these products go to outside markets, are exported, the timber, the agriculture, but also the gold. Half of the gold that Brazil exports is illegal there. So it's really international law enforcement is crucial that the demand markets take responsibility of all these crimes as well. So kind of shared responsibility.
That was Tim Bukat van Solinga, PhD, an independent criminologist and founder-director of the Forest Forces Foundation, speaking on a webinar entitled A Scientific Look at the 2023 World Drug Report that was held on July 6th by UNODC and the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.